Okay, well, a warm welcome back. And thank you very much. That was a remarkable trip or ride. I wonder if, to start with, if maybe I could just come back to what you said at the beginning in relation to the musical inspiration of the film. Because it seems to me that for people who know you perhaps best for Los Angeles Plays Itself or for Red Hollywood, that they may be surprised to come across a film that is sort of fundamentally musical or symphonic in conception. But in fact, it's an extension of a kind of strand of your work that goes back to the 60s, to a rock and roll movie, and then more recently to Get Out of the Car, which is a kind of coda, if you like, to Los Angeles Plays Itself, which is presented explicitly as a city symphony. And it just strikes me that one way of thinking about what we've just seen is as a kind of film historical symphony. So I just wonder if you could just sort of say something really about the sort of musical inspiration and background and conception of the film.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. I'm in your formulation. Well, I've always been like a fan of music and movies, and as you say, there's also this movie Olivia's Place, which is a you just hear a single song in its entirety in the movie, and that's basically the whole soundtrack of the movie. And of course, Get Out of the Car is kind of a musical movie. All these little snatches of music. This time, I kind of enjoyed playing with music, and sometimes in the silent movies, creating soundtracks that weren't originally part of the movie. You know, like using Charles Ives for the Stroheim section and for the Griffith Strike section, and then Throne of Blood at the end, instead of replacing his music with Shostakovich, the October Symphony. Although sometimes I did use the music that was on the DVDs, like the music at the very beginning, also the music for Battleship Potemkin is the score, the original score. The same with the birth of a Nation. Well, yeah, The Birth of a Nation, Intolerance. But then the other section from Intolerance was the elevator shot or the crane shot was the music from Michael Nyman did for the Ziga Vertov films, they're released by the Austrian Film Museum. What else? Yeah, and then of course there's the blues and the Rolling Stones when I think their music meant something. And the zombies on the TV and Bunny Lake is Missing, which I quite liked. And the blues numbers by Sleepy John Estes and Skip James. So in this case, it was, as in Get Out of the Car, it was music that I like. When I'm, one of the sources of this film was this course I've been teaching periodically for a long time, which is it's a course on Deleuze's cinema books, but it's a course, it's not at all a theoretical course or a film studies course. It's a course for filmmakers and what they could gain from his ideas, how they can think more about images and montage. In that course, I most of the work is putting together clips that illustrate what he's talking about, because I think the difficulty of that book is that the range of references is so broad that people maybe can't understand, because without knowing the movies that he's talking about. So I try to make the books understandable by showing the movies that he's talking about, as well as other movies that, of course, have appeared since the book was published that also illustrate his ideas, as I guess I did here. I think every class I try to have some kind of musical number to lighten things up a bit. And it's the same with other courses that I've taught in the past that involve excerpts, showing clips from films, which I think is a good way to teach. So yeah, I always try to have something, some kind of musical number.
I mean, it seems to me, I don't know what other people felt, but it seemed to me that a knowledge of Deleuze's cinema books would probably enhance one's appreciation of your film. But in fact, it's not essential at all. And I think if you didn't, you have never read those books or never even come across the ideas, there's enough in there. There's enough kind of hooks and pointers to guide us through as an audience. And it seems to me that one of the kind of motivating gestures of the film was as much, in fact, that of kind of preservation and transmission of kind of key moments from film history. Just to relate it back to Get Out of the Car again, there's a moment when you're filming outside and you're kind of filming like a vacant lot or a kind of bulldozed area, I can't remember, an empty building, and somebody asks, what are you doing? And you, or at least whoever's filming, says, we're just trying to document what's left. So it's, and it just struck me that there's a similar kind of gesture here in relation to film history, trying to document and preserve and then transmit a kind of a trace or a record or a memory of the amazing things that cinema achieved. And that kind of becomes explicit towards the end, that this kind of gesture, we've got to kind of retrieve cinema and give it back to those who have nothing.
Yeah, I hope that I don't think I don't think it matters that much about whether you've read Deleuze or not. My only fear is that some people might be feel that if they don't understand all of the quotations, that they might feel that there's something they're missing, that it would, in that sense, maybe put people off. But the Deleuze is just really a kind of structuring device, I guess. It's not, except at the very end where there is, where I am trying to show what he's saying, And that's maybe the one important part for me. Let's see, what was the other part of your question had to do with,
The film is a kind of record, of a kind of a compendium of kind of, you know, key achievements.
Yeah, sure. What I wanted to say about that, first of all, is that the title may be a little misleading in that it's not a death of the cinema movie. It's not saying that this is something that is past and that we're mourning what once was. Actually, I think that now we're in the age of cinema, and more than ever, that, I could put it this way, that all of the arts today are aspiring to the condition of cinema. At one time I called it, this was kind of working title, Great Moments in the History of Cinema. But of course, I didn't want to include stuff that was sort of, you know, like you'd get in a Chuck Braverman movie. Scenes that everyone would recognize. I wanted to pick scenes that would, I hope that there would be, discoveries for almost anybody watching this movie, and maybe that's the case. Some of these things that are familiar could be kind of defamiliarized by the context in which they appear in this movie. For example, the series of close-up shots or affection images at the beginning of the film. some of those are of course famous shots that most people would recognize who are, you know, have some knowledge of film history. But I thought recontextualizing them would give them a kind of poignance that maybe they don't have in the context of the original film. For example, the Griffith shot of the Intolerance set. In Intolerance, it's actually split up quite a bit. It doesn't follow the whole. You don't see the whole shot as a single shot, but rather you see it interspersed with a lot of other scenes from Babylon. So I thought it would be nice for people to have a chance to see it as a, you know, sort of integral whole. There are, you know, cuts so that we mask the cuts by putting in the intertitles from Ziga Vertov, 1/6 of the Earth. And there are other, that's, I guess, the sort of general principle that there are scenes that exist kind of as scenes, although, you know, they're not, there are cuts in them. The scene of Maria Montez in Cobra Woman is, you know, actually maybe twice as long. The same with the following scene of Deborah Padgett dancing in the Indian Tomb by Fritz Lang. What else? One thing, there's that, the two sort of factory shots from Ziga Vertov, and what attracted me about the second shot was that it reminded me of Wavelength. Mm-hmm. That happened to you too? Good. Yeah, so it's not a completely idle association. So, yeah, I thought that was another way of kind of suggesting combinations and things.
I mean, it seems to me that the kind of passage where you move furthest away from Deleuze and, in a sense, furthest from cinema history is in the quite lengthy passage where you deal with Hiroshima, where you and North Korea, Vietnam, where you're basically working with, you know, archival documentary material. And I'm thinking particularly of your treatment of North Korea, where there's, I mean, the footage is of a very different kind of quality to most of the rest of the film. But there's also a real sense of anger, you know, just kind of that comes through on your part through the inclusion of that material, but also the intertitle that you put up with it, you know.
Yeah. All of the newsreel footage, though, is actually, you know, it's not stuff that I compiled. It all comes from other compilation movies. Mm. The scene of North Korea is from a television series that was done by Thames Television called Korea, the Unknown War. Mm-hmm. Although I added a little bit of another film, actually, a film made by the North Korean Peace Committee called Germ Warfare in Korea. I guess in a way that's where one might make a comparison with Histoire du Cinéma. That is, that I wanted to show the cinema had documented the history and the horrors of the 20th century. Which maybe puts me at odds a bit with what he was proposing in that movie.
Insofar as in Histoire du Cinéma, he's identifying gaps in the kind of coverage of the century.
The notion that there weren't resistance films being made during the Second World War. There weren't... the movies failed to, I don't know. To me, it's a little ambiguous what he's saying, but you could explain it. The notion of the cinema and the Holocaust and the cinema's failure in relation to the Holocaust, which is actually something that I talk about in Red Hollywood, right? I show the Hollywood film, none, what's it called?
None Shall Escape.
Right, None Shall Escape. That is an allusion to, the murder of the Jews. And there are also a number of Hollywood films that let's say intelligent films made during the war about Nazi Germany, and quite strong anti-Nazi films. It's not just The Great Dictator and To Be or Not to Be, which I discovered. I watched it again recently. I discovered I didn't like it. I'm sorry. Although I like the Great Dictator more and more. Another film I mentioned in Red Hollywood is The Man I Married, which I think is a strong anti-Nazi film made in around the time of The Great Dictator in 1940. And I could have extended that analysis a lot farther. Particularly, I would have liked to have shown a film called Hostages that was written by Lester Cole, which is the fascinating thing about Hostages. It's the film that it's the film that Brecht wanted to make when he wrote Hangman Also Die, but was frustrated by Fritz Lang's desire to make his film. But Hostages is a very it's like the original treatment of Hangman Also Die. Unfortunately, we couldn't show that in Red Hollywood because it's never been out on DVD or anything, so it was impossible to get a copy to show. The thoughts that once we have, there's nothing about the Holocaust, but there's I talked about things that weren't so familiar or forgotten, exactly like the bombing of North Korea, the siege of Leningrad. Of course, then there's Hiroshima Mon Amour, and there's the 17th parallel, which are maybe more familiar. But what interested me about treating the Hiroshima Mon Amour was, of course, that it began as another one of his short documentaries, a documentary about Hiroshima, and I discovered that actually that's really the part of the film that I like the best. So I thought it would be interesting to isolate that part of the film, and you know, turn it back into a documentary about the bomb and about divisions, you know, one class against another class, one people against another people. Now that is fundamental to what happened there. And then also, I don't know, in the United States, the 17th parallel is a pretty unknown film. It was shown a little bit in political contexts. That's how I saw it originally. You know, as a part of an anti-war program or a teach-in or something. But it was never. I guess it did have a very small theatrical release because it did get reviewed, but maybe just in New York. So that was important because it was an unknown film originally. There was going to be one of the sequences that he shot for Far From Vietnam, but in the end, I thought this was both stronger and probably less familiar. And I've strayed away from something.
Can I just ask you about?
Oh yeah, we were talking about Histoire du Cinéma. I was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a sense, it's not unrelated to Histoire du Cinéma, but methodologically, in relation to Red Hollywood and Los Angeles Plays Itself, you've clearly moved. You've taken a very deliberate decision to move away from voiceover, from talking heads, even from kind of shooting your own material and integrating it in favor of just allowing the clips and the montage to kind of speak for itself. So,
well, that was the appeal of this film for me. That it wasn't going to have a voiceover, and originally it didn't have quite as many intertitles as it ended up with. But I don't know; they just seemed necessary. For sure. I mean, you know, in a way, this is a kind of outgrowth of the last film I did, the Tony Longo trilogy, which maybe is not so well known. But yeah, it's a movie I like.
Yeah, which I have seen and I like very much too, which again has no voiceover.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, sort of recut clips.
Yeah. Kind of an attempt to make a dumb movie, and this was too, in a way, I think. Trying to make a dumb movie, kind of. I hope I succeeded.
Maybe we should see if anyone would like to ask us some questions. Does anyone have a question they'd like to ask? I think we might have a mic there. Yeah.
There is a person.
Yeah, Tom, I've very much enjoyed it. And a particular sort of segment that I really enjoyed was the Timothy Carey sequence. I just wanted to ask why you chose him. What was it about him that you loved? Because I love him too, as a sort of maverick, crazy guy.
a certain kind of excess, I guess. There was a book a long time ago that Ian Cameron wrote. It was called Heavies. Is that the title? Something like that. Yeah, there is a section on Timothy Carey, and he shows, not only does he show a lot of teeth, he shows a lot of gum. James Ellroy said that he could even overact playing a corpse in East of Eden. Elia Kazan had to kick him to try to get him to stop moving while he was supposedly dead. He's a great screen presence, right? He should have been a bigger star. I guess he was difficult. Well, he also gives you, the sense kind of that he's making it up as he goes along, like in his monologue from Minnie and Moskowitz. I don't know if it's true there, but he kind of, almost exists outside of the movie, like Jack Nicholson in some movies, or Marlon Brando in some movies. Yeah. Also, I'm fond of Marlon Brando. Although maybe not for his most famous parts, but some of the others. I wish we tried to include a scene from The Missouri Breaks, but it just didn't. It didn't work. It would have had to have been too long, and in that movie, it's hard to kind of show any of his performance out of context. So, but that's one of my favorite of his films. Also, The Chase, which we could show.
Would I be wrong in thinking that there's maybe more clips from Godard than any other director?
Yeah. No, I think you would be right. Which is something we worried about a little at one point. But it's kind of odd because, in Deleuze's book, Godard is maybe the most important figure in the second book, The Time Image. There's more pages devoted to him than to any other director. But in doing the class, I always had great difficulty in finding something from Godard to show. So I don't know, I had a kind of breakthrough reading something that enabled me to maybe finally understand Godard. Maybe it was just putting together the close-ups from Godard movies at the beginning and the notion of, the shots in his films could be kind of classified in a way. And there are shots, I think, that he rediscovered. I really do think he kind of rediscovered the close-up or the affection image, and the landscape shot. Or maybe it was his last film, Farewell to Language, was showing in Los Angeles. I was asked to introduce one of the screenings, and I agreed to do so just so I could, you know, see the movie for free. I went to the screening right before the one I was supposed to introduce and saw the movie, and then introduced it and then watched it again. I had to think of something to say. Maybe it was rereading Colin McCabe's book also. There could be a way of kind of periodizing his work. The films up to the Ziga Vertov films, and then the sort of essay films from, including the Ziga Vertov films, and then the films beginning with his, you know, Return to Cinema, Sauve qui peut la vie. I thought in this last period, which at first there were a lot of films in that period that I didn't care for so much at first. But then I was thinking that he's moved out. He's moved from the city to the country, and landscapes are, you know. He developed this beautiful way of filming landscapes, which is a striking thing about that. So that in a way, there's kind of more at stake in those films because the earth is at stake. So I've grown to appreciate those films more. I think there were a number of landscapes at the end, and also, of course, the seascapes from film Socialism. So, I suppose all of the Godard shots belong to a certain kind of typology of shots that I worked out in relation to Godard. And then for me, that scene in Made in USA with Marianne Faithfull and Anna Karina and Laszlo Szabo and Jean-Pierre Léaud is particularly beautiful because of the looks that are exchanged among them. It's one of the purest examples I know of cinema as an art of the look, you know. The melody of the regard, or the melody of the look, which is something basic to cinema, but something which is actually, it seems to me, rather rare, and maybe rarer these days than it used to be. So that's how Godard came to figure so prominently in this movie.
Do you have any other questions? Yeah, in the middle here.
Hi, thank you very much. I was interested to hear that you said earlier that because Deleuze, his original book, it spanned quite a wide range of cinema at the time it was written. In comparison to the movies that were made after his death, that I noticed, like Millennium Mambo, Film Socialism, I Think There Was Clean by Jem Coleman. What kinds of things do you look for in more recent films that kind of go on, that have shown some influence by Deleuze's work at all?
Well, I mean, it's not as if anyone is influenced by his work. I don't know if... I hope the students in my class were. But aside from that, I don't know if anyone is. But Millennium Mambo is an example of what he calls movement of world, what examples does he give? I mean, one example that he gives is a movie we would call Elevator to the Gallows. I guess you all here would call it Lift to the Scaffold. Because of the main character getting stuck in the elevator, his movement interrupted movement is carried on to these other characters. So there's a sequence there about movement of world, although there isn't any reference explaining the relation of those shots to his idea. The notion is that there's a kind of movement which is doesn't really seem to belong to the character, but is like the world is coming out to meet the character in order to affect the movement that the character is unable to accomplish. He places musical comedy under this rubric. But to me, that's always a great moment in cinema where you have the sense of a character moving, but the movement comes from outside the character. There are great examples of that in the beginning and end of Lumière d'Été. But also in Sunrise, where the characters are on this, it seems actually that they're on a kind of, I guess they're just standing in front of a process screen, and the process screen is moving forward. So there's a sense that they're moving and they're not moving. Or I suppose another example would be the famous shot in Psycho where Hitchcock and, what is it? He pulls back and zooms forward, or maybe it's the other way around. But so to create this effect of a character moving but not moving, or that the movement comes from elsewhere. So that's Millennium Mambo, and. Yeah, what else is recent films? Jem Coen. Twist. The film about Hank Ballard and Chubby Checker. I mean, there's a Deleuzian point made there, which I hope is clear. But anyway, again, that's an aspect of social history that I wanted to bring into the film. That is that to understand American culture, it's important to talk about the part of it that's black culture. So I was, you know, I guess that doesn't have anything to do with exactly with Deleuze's book, although maybe it does, but that was just something else that I wanted to do in the movie. The twist, it's something that, you know, it's always kind of, I feel a kind of rage about that also, which I don't know if that comes through in Ron Mann's film, but, you know, something that, you know, it happened to Hank Ballard previously as well. He made this this record called Work With Me, Annie, which had, you know, there was a kind of follow-up record called Annie Had a Baby. But Work With Me, Annie became Rock With Me, Henry, and then it, I think in the end it was actually covered by Pat Boone, who had a hit with it. So he's a person who, you know, really got ripped off and never made it, and ended up kind of, you know, he could no longer afford to perform with a band in the Midnighters. He just would go around performing in little clubs with pickup bands, kind of like Big J. McNeely does now. I lost my train of thought again. Okay, well, I don't know. Maybe that's enough of an answer to that question, I hope.
Okay, do we maybe have one last question? Yeah, one up the front here. If you could wait just a sec then so that other people can hear.
Hi. I was wondering about the final citation of the film. I'm going to missay it, but I think it's something like we should restore cinema to those who have nothing. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what you think that would look like.
Oh. You know, the Straubs used to talk about they were making cinema for peasants, farmers, I guess, as opposed to city people. I don't know if that's what it would look like. I guess it's more, it's not so much maybe the films that get made as it is a matter of the ways in which they might be shown. That is that once upon a time, films were shown in very different contexts, in more political contexts, but also in the context of popular culture, you know, the days of the popular front in the United States. So I think that's kind of what a restoration would look like. It would look like it would be a matter of bringing people together in different ways and in different contexts, and also, of course, it would be a matter of presenting movies to people who don't have access to them now, or people, you know, people whose access is limited in one way or another. I think that's what I meant. Yeah, I know it's kind of the two quotations are sort of reversed. I mean, obviously, it's more important that. Restoring the entire earth to people who have nothing is more important than restoring the cinema to them. I was aware of that, but that's kind of just the way it turned out.
Okay, I think we better draw things to a close. It's getting late.
Yeah.
But just to invite everyone to thank Tom very much again for coming and showing his film and talking about it. Thank you very, very much.
Well, I'd really like to thank you for coming and helping me to understand it. So, thank you.